Well, well, welcome to Between Sundays. I'm Tyler, and can I get a shout out for Theodora? Today we're redirecting our zeal to talk about the power of transformation in Jesus, but before we sing Amazing Grace, now that they've gone house to house dragging out both men and women to throw them into prison, let's welcome in our favorite zealots, Maren and Barry. Good day, guys.
Zealous for the Lord.
That's right. Good day.
Guys, is zeal good or bad? I can't tell.
Zeal for you completely consumes me. My daughter was sitting behind me in service, and the first time you said zeal, that's she started singing that to her brother.
Yeah.
Zeal. Zeal's good.
Zeal's good. It's like zest. You want zest for life.
Yeah. Right?
You can be zealous for the wrong thing, as we'll talk about later,
we'll talk
or
about
zealous
that.
For the right thing. But I think zeal is, it's great. It's all good. Right.
I'm a 7 on the Enneagram, so you know I like zeal. I'm all about zeal. I'm zeal.
It's just every
zealous.
Time I see a reference like in the Bible about zeal, it's like people are dying.
Zeal misconstrued or zeal.
There's a scripture that says zeal for the house of the Lord consumes me. And that's like in a positive light. Like, I long for your courts. Yeah. I'm consumed with zeal for your house.
Yeah. All right.
Fervor.
We'll get there. guys, it's been a couple weeks.
Took a couple weeks off.
We had spring break and then the eclipse.
Yeah.
That was
awesome.
Big eclipse.
Wasn't it? Was it better than you thought it would be?
It was way better than I thought
Maren,
it would be.
Maren did something sneaky.
Sneaky?
Well, like. Sneaky awesome, right?
Oh, I did something epic. I wouldn't call it sneaky.
Well, it's sneaky because you didn't tell anyone else that you were doing it. It's like I would have appreciated knowing that that's something that I could do. Tell everybody what you did.
Okay, so I had this plan all along. We were invited to the farm, and we were almost going to go to the farm. My mother-in-law really wanted to go meet the animals and watch the eclipse.
Yeah.
But even had we gone to your house, my plan was to wear one earbud and to start Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon at 2:23 p.m.
You got it all
so
mapped
that
out.
Right at the end of the album, as that last lyric is being sung, it would be totality. And the last song on Dark Side of the Moon is actually called Eclipse.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me.
That was my plan anyhow. But anyway, through a series of events, we decided to stay home and watch the eclipse. From the comfort of our own backyard. We didn't even have to go anywhere special. It was amazing to be able to do that. And I pulled the speaker out to the yard where we were all sitting, and we just all got to chill and listen to Dark Side of the Moon start to finish.
Did it work?
Did it cry?
Beautiful.
Did you cry? Like, what were the emotions?
Oh my goodness.
I was weeping uncontrollably.
Yeah, I think I cried a little bit, but it was more like, I was so excited. I love that album for one. And for that to be like the backdrop of the total eclipse of the sun.
Wow.
No. That was the best 54 minutes and 20 seconds of my life. And there shall be none better. That was so epic. And my kids loved it too. They were like, "You're right, Mom. That album was the right choice."
Nice.
All right.
Yeah. So I created a family memory.
Good.
What about you guys?
Done. Yeah, we went to there's a church across around the block. We went to sit in the parking lot and watched it, and my kids couldn't care less. I mean, we were there for, I don't know, we had lunch there and made an afternoon of it. And I kept saying, "Guys, come on, you can see it's like, put your glasses on. You can see it's like the sun looks like a moon, like it looks like a crescent moon." They're like, "Yeah, we just want to play basketball." And They ended up looking at it, but I don't know if they obviously didn't pick up on like the mastery of it all. Yeah.
Did they pick up on anything when things suddenly fell dark and quiet?
Yeah, they thought it was weird and cool, but
and cold.
Yeah. I was like, "Guys, you will never experience this again."
Yeah.
Here, you'll never do it again.
Right.
And they're like, "Can I have your Jimmy John's?" That was our experience.
Cool.
Barry, you had people over at the farm?
Yeah, I had a few people, some Haven Farm supporters and some staff came over and their families. So it was great. It was kind of a chill, just group of people hanging out in the field. The cool thing was two interesting things happened. I was very interested to see how the animals would react. The pigs.
I just need to look at the birds.
Exactly. The pigs couldn't care less. They just kind of kept rooting around. They were fine. But all the chickens were out in the outside run. And when it got dark, they all just sat down like, I guess it's nighttime. So they all just kind of started roosting. They're like, "Well, didn't get time to get back."
I guess I'll just sleep here.
Yeah. And also the moment it got dark, bats came out and started flying around.
We did see bats. Yeah.
I saw bats too.
It's crazy. I was not expecting that. So it was really cool. It was very profound. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot cooler than I thought it was going to be.
Uh-huh.
Like I heard all the hoopla mm-hmm. about it, but yeah. I was like, okay, like,
right.
So what? It gets dark every day. Like big deal. But it really got really dark and it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. And yeah. we were just so lucky. My sisters in North Carolina sent me pictures. My friend in Chicago sent me pictures and they didn't see what we saw.
Right. Yeah.
It was so special to be here. Yeah. Well, they didn't get totality.
Oh, right, right, right. There was like thunderstorms during some parts mm-hmm. In Texas maybe. Mm. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the most beautiful, perfect weather. Again, great family memory now.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What else is new? What's going on in the past couple of weeks? What have you guys been up to?
I'm still trying to get these built-in cabinets and bookshelves built.
Oh yeah, what's the update?
Well, now I'm at the point in the project where I have completely lost all steam, ground to a halt, and it is just agony to get myself out there because it's the finicky stuff of like sanding a million little pieces of trim and then figuring out how to fix this problem. It's coming along and they're gonna look amazing when they're done. I'm really pleased with how they look, but my commitment to try to use all this salvaged wood for all the trim and everything and the doors has been testing my patience.
A little harder than you thought it might be.
Way more work than I thought it was going to be. And so anyway, I'm fine. It's just, that's what I've been spending my time on. That and the garden. I'm getting lots of stuff growing and so I've got my free time pretty full.
How's that corn coming along?
I haven't planted it yet. Oh. That'll be like this week. Sometime I'll stick it in the ground. So
don't act like you're a big show.
All right, maybe I'll do it next week. Yeah, no, so that's good. What about you guys?
Yeah, Maren, what's new with you?
Well, I got to go home on Saturday. I was invited to a conference for local pastors in the South Suburban Chicagoland area.
Oh,
one of
cool.
my pastoral mentors was hosting the conference, and he told me about it a couple months ago. And so Jed and I both went out, which was super cool. It was kind of... He had three different groups: legacy pastors. Those were pastors with like 40 something years mm-hmm. of experience. And then there were the pastors who are kind of in it now. That was me and my husband was there with me. And then there was kind of next generation. And it was just kind of everybody talking about trends we're seeing or issues we're facing mm-hmm. for both the Big C church and our local churches. And it was really thought provoking, really awesome. I have a ton of notes on it. It was good for my soul to be there. It was really, really good to be home. But he is starting a podcast, and I know that the viewer cannot see or the listener cannot see, but guys, he made our table.
Oh, that's...
What do you mean he made our table?
Same style. He had come here a couple, maybe 2 years ago and he was scoping out our podcast space and took all these pictures of the original table that Jim Swanson had built for us.
Shout out to Jim.
Shout out to you, Jim. Your table has been replicated elsewhere.
We're not using that table.
Yeah, we don't use
it
anymore.
Where is it? Right.
You could have just taken the one we have.
Yeah.
He was so excited to take me up to that recording studio and say, I want to show you something. So that was all inspired by what we do here.
Yeah.
So it was good. It was a nice trip home. The day started in the South Suburbs, and then a friend of mine, her 4-year-old's birthday party was happening to be that day, starting at around like 5 o'clock. So we went into the city, celebrated with her and her little one, and that was super fun. On the way home, we always stop for coffee in Munster, Indiana. Like that's where Jed and I had lived.
That's where you go for good coffee.
Right before moving here to central Indiana, we made a brief little pit stop in Munster. And I cannot help, I'm constantly replaying the tape in my head of like, man, what would life have been like if we never would have left Munster?
Yeah.
Wow. And I'm seeing all these little places of, oh, Desi could have worked at that boba shop. And Jed was finally like, you love torturing yourself.
Why would you do that?
Why do you do this? And so we had a conversation and I was like, you know what? No. Could I imagine my life without ever having met the two of you?
No, that's right.
No.
You're welcome.
I can't even imagine
all the other universes, the multiverse, those all are lame compared to this multiverse.
I can't imagine.
You didn't even know what a podcast was when you lived in Munster, Indiana.
That's true. Yes. So anyway, I thought that was funny.
Yeah. Well, since we last recorded, I have successfully traveled to and from Florida with three children.
You did. Please give us the update because I feel like half of the last podcast we did was dedicated to your worries and fears of navigating the airport.
No fears anymore. It was easy peasy. It actually was a lot easier than I thought. But the week leading up to it, the baby got sick. Mm. So she was sick. And my wife, it was like Tuesday. We left on a Monday, the Monday after Easter. But it was like the Tuesday before the baby got sick. And she's like, trip's basically ruined.
Yeah.
Because everybody's just going to get sick. And she started freaking out a couple days earlier than when we were to leave. But the morning we left, Milo actually did get very, very sick. And he was like...
On the way back home.
No, on the way to the morning before we were going to leave. We left at like 3 p.m. So we had to leave early afternoon to get to the airport. And all morning, he was just like puking his guts out.
Oh,
and so, buddy. Of course, we're like, man, I don't know. Like, do we have to tell people? Like, what do you do when you're... Like, do you try to like reschedule your ticket, or do you just like hide it? They give you those doggy bags, just like just keep it quiet kind of thing. So we elected to push through and brought him to the airport, and he puked on his way into the airport.
Ugh.
But then, and all the whole flight, he was like, I don't feel good. And he had the bag with him and the whole thing, but he never lost it, and then the rest of the trip was perfect.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and travel was easier than I thought, because it was like we pulled up to the curb and they do curbside check-in.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't even have to haul. Like, my biggest fear was that I would have like a backpack strapped to like three sides of me plus a car seat plus two suitcases and trying to figure out how to carry it all. And that never really manifested. It was just like I had to carry everybody's backpack because Milo was sick, but yeah, it was really easy. And then when we got there, it was like, I successfully avoided getting into the dark waters of the ocean.
Nice.
I didn't have to do that because it was cold and nobody wanted to get into the water. There was a pool there, so we did a lot of pool time. But all in all, great trip. And I would do it again. I would travel with the children again.
You would recommend.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got, Lauren and I are a good team. Like, if you've got easy kids, our kids were pretty easy. And if you can check car seats like that, it's pretty.
How'd the baby do? Was this baby's first flight?
Baby's first flight. She was great. I mean, she fell asleep on the flight and no problem.
She's just the best baby.
Yeah. She really is a perfect little cherub.
The biggest issue of the flight was Lane, who's four. And every single time he got a drink on an airplane, he spilled it into his lap. Every single time. It's like, I want a Sprite. All right, Sprite. Within 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Here's Sprite into his lap.
I understand him.
And he's like, does Sprite dry? I'm like, yeah, but not while we're on the airplane.
Sprite.
So that's what's new with us. But we're back, and it was a good experience overall.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
You did it.
Thanks.
You've leveled up in your parenting.
I know. My biggest win was not getting into the ocean. Yeah. All right, guys. We are hitting our final week of our 9-week series.
10 weeks.
10-week series.
Everybody was going on and on about how long that series, and everybody, I mean, like the lead team, like Amy, you guys, we've done longer series.
I loved
series.
It.
Yeah. Okay. I like long series.
Yeah. Our series Witness just wrapped up this past weekend, and 10 weeks. It does feel like we started a long time ago, but I've loved the content of it. Mm-hmm. But Barry, you're here because you gave the message and because you're our favorite zealot co-host. But can you kind of give us the big idea of what you had to wrap up the series with?
Sure. I thought if you looked at the series and who we talked about and when we talked about them, there was a very, very slight chronological order. Like, we started with John the Baptist, and we ended this past weekend with the Apostle Paul. So the Apostle Paul, his encounter with Christ, he kind of was one of the last people that is considered an apostle because he had a face-to-face encounter with the risen Christ. So anyway, I thought let's end with him. Besides, I've got plenty of thoughts about Paul. So I thought, let me see if I can dip my toes into those waters and share. So basically we looked at the moment, the transformative moment that he had, where he went from being a Christian persecuting zealous Pharisee to becoming a Gentile including zealous apostle. His complete transformation, or I called it a redirection by Jesus, to take who he was, the zealous person he was, and to channel that zeal into the kingdom of God. Yeah. So that was the idea. And as far as like application, my big idea was just to kind of consider, okay, what do we learn about Jesus and about ourselves from this moment in the Apostle Paul's life? And we learn things like, sometimes Jesus doesn't change who we are. He just redirects us, which I would argue he did with Paul. Following Christ requires surrender. And, I don't remember my third point at the moment. So do you remember it? You've got it written down?
I'm sure I've got it written down.
Yeah, it was,
your past doesn't define you. Jesus calls you still.
That's number two.
Point
yeah.
two A.
Yeah. Or maybe that was point three.
Will you
doesn't
trust
matter.
In his grace?
Will you trust in his grace? I don't know. It's all right. So anyway, the
oh,
point,
yeah. Will yeah, you trust it. In his grace?
Was
that's
the last
it.
Question.
I wrote it
yeah.
right there.
Yeah. Anyway, so I wanted us to see ourselves a bit in the Apostle Paul, even though, frankly, he gets a bad rap. I thought maybe we could talk about that if we wanted to. But
yeah.
But yeah, that was basically the message. The big idea is just that Jesus had completely other plans for this.
Yeah.
Very, very, this man that was very hostile to the early church.
Yeah. I want to get into Paul in a second. The entire time that I was listening about Paul, mm-hmm. which by the way, never mind. The entire time I was listening to about Paul, I was like, what did everybody else think? Like, there's this guy who's one way and yeah. then obviously has this big transformation, but did early Christians know about Saul prior to him and his transformation to like when he did do the transformation part, they were like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like, were they skeptical of him at all? Or like, do we have understanding of how he was treated by the Christian community?
We have a hint mm-hmm. in Ananias, the guy that prays over him.
Yeah, he was kind of worried.
He's freaked out. He's like, yeah. Lord, please don't send me to this guy. He's yeah. going to put me in jail.
His reputation preceded him.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then we also get a sense from when he begins preaching in Damascus, this like absolute confusion of like, wait, him? This guy is the one that, so clearly he had a reputation. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know that if there are many more references to like when he meets with the apostles in Jerusalem, what did they think about that?
Yeah.
I think we kind of have to infer that perhaps people started hearing what had been going on in Damascus and when, mm-hmm. Yeah.
He refers to his own reputation quite a bit in his writings.
Yeah.
I was the chief of sinners. Right. He's
the least of the apostles. Yeah.
He's even telling others about, you know, what he did.
Yeah.
Do we have any idea how long it was from like transformation moment to, I don't know, meeting with the apostles or like how long of a period was that?
So this is where the book of Acts leaves out some crucial information that Paul himself refers to later. He went to Damascus and then he didn't go to Jerusalem. He went probably to Mount Sinai in the desert. He actually probably made a pilgrimage to Mount Sinai. Cause he says he went to Arabia for 3 years. Or is it 3 years? Something like that. So there's this time where he goes off and I think, or N.T. Wright in his biography of Paul, he gets into this, but he thinks it's this is Paul coming to grips with this entirely new perspective on the entire mission of God. Like the idea that Jesus was the Christ, was the Messiah, was so fundamentally reorienting to his entire worldview that he needed to like basically figure things out. So he went where Elijah, remember I mentioned Elijah was the zealous prophet. Well, he went where Elijah went to get confirmation of his call, which was the place, the mountain where the Israelites first received God's law, the Torah. He went to Mount Sinai. We don't know what happened there, but he also later refers to being having this vision where he was caught up to the seventh heaven or something like that. And so,
love that show.
Yeah. And so he talks about this transcendent experience he has. It's possible that that's what he had on Mount Sinai, that this was like a mystical experience of coming to grips with the risen Christ. And then he goes back to Damascus. Has to flee the city because they're trying to, he has to go out the window. That's the whole story in Acts. And then he goes to Jerusalem. And then he went and spent about a decade in Tarsus and did work there that we are not told what happened. But he definitely would have spent some time in the region.
This is tent making?
Tent making, probably preaching, probably having his wife divorce him. Like all kinds of drama. I wish we knew. We don't. All we know is that after that period of time, so probably 13, 14 years after this Damascus Road experience. He begins his missionary journeys. He starts planting churches.
Okay, you can't just drop the probably have his wife divorce him and not explain to people who don't know where that thought comes from.
Yeah, okay. So the main bit of evidence that we have is that, well, it's not even evidence, it's inference. Mm-hmm. If he was a Pharisee, all Pharisees would have been married. They would have been, that's like an expectation, a basic life expectation for a Pharisee. So he probably was married. We also get hints in some of his letters that that his family essentially rejected him in Tarsus when he went back. And so you could put some two and two together. And then later by 1 Corinthians, he's talking about being single. He said, I wish everyone was as I am because I can give myself wholly to the Lord, et cetera. And so you put all these pieces together and you can perhaps put a story together that he went back to Tarsus and his wife just could not deal with this changed perspective. Maybe she never came around to the idea of Jesus as Lord and left him or
got mad that he went to Mount Sinai for 3 years.
Where have
you been?
Although that kind of thing happened a lot more than you'd think of like a spouse leaving for like a year and coming back. Guys went off to war and come back like 2 years later.
But wouldn't you tell your wife, hey, I'm going off to war?
Well, maybe. Maybe you sent a letter like, dear Gretchen.
Gretchen.
Anyway. So it's all just inference. It's possible he was single the whole time. And when he talks about his family, he's referring to parents. He's talking about brothers and sisters. I don't know. Mm. So.
Because one of my questions is he went from persecuting Christians to becoming Christian leader, and he had to have obviously this reputation. And how long was it before like that reputation was just like in the back of people's minds instead of the front of people's minds? And how long was it before like his actions as zealot Jewish guy didn't undermine what he was trying to do?
Right. I wonder because that you do see like pretty much once he's into his ministry, he becomes a real leading apostle for the inclusion of Gentiles. Peter was the first one to kind of broach the topic and had this first experience of actually like realizing, oh, God wants to anoint the Gentiles with the Holy Spirit too. That's crazy. But it's Paul who really makes massive inroads with that. And he's kind of the reason why the Jerusalem Council happens. I want to say Acts 16. I don't know if that's true. Probably not. Anyway, we'll look it up. But that they have to have a whole council where all the apostles come together to figure out what do we do with these Gentiles that want to join the church. So Paul, I mean, he went from the guy who persecuted everybody and now he wants to be one of us to... And now he goes and he thinks that he's supposed to just include all these Gentiles. He's changing our plan. He didn't even walk the earth with Jesus. We did, you know, that kind of thing. So I imagine he was always kind of the odd man out.
Yeah.
But again, we just have some inferences. We don't have the hard and fast data.
So that led me to ask the question, like, how do we discern, how should we discern like genuine transformation versus like performative? Because obviously Paul was like, this was a genuine thing that happened to him.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's go down the list of Christian leaders, not that he is one, but Kanye West a couple years ago apparently had this big transformation. He came out with this Christian music album, and there were churches and Christians who were like, yes, come to our church and perform or whatever. And other people were like, not so fast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out I don't know. But so you start asking the question, like, how should we discern whether and where was that happening at Paul's time, like whether this was a genuine thing or performative?
Right. Well, I think you get a hint by looking at the way that he responds to these other quote unquote super apostles that show up in Corinth. I talked about this. It was on the podcast. I think we talked about it when we were in Corinthians at one point, but he has some strong words. He's like, yeah, these guys are super impressive. They've got like a great credibility because they're great speakers and they're super attractive and they're amazing. But let me tell you my credentials. And then he starts listing out all of the suffering that he's done for Christ. He's like, I experienced this and this and this and this and this. And it's like, he's saying, look, that's my testimony. And he's essentially saying, those are my credentials. That's my proof that I am who I say I am. Yeah. And I'm authentic. These guys haven't suffered.
Yeah.
And And so that's my first gut reaction to that question. Is like, it's, you almost can't say, you can't prove through your words that I'm genuine. You prove through your actions and through what you're willing to, to what costs are you willing to incur for the sake of the thing you say you believe?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. Was there a bunch of stuff like you wish you had said or stuff left on the cutting room floor about this? I feel like you could probably preach 20 sermons on Paul, but like,
yeah, for sure.
Is there stuff that you were waiting to talk about here? Maybe that you didn't get to talk about in your sermon.
I told you guys earlier, I completely changed my intro on Saturday morning. I had a completely different intro. And so it is the thing that I kind of would love to share. I think Paul gets a bad rap, especially in circles of people who are in a phase of questioning their faith, maybe deconstructing their faith, because so many people, when they think about the Apostle Paul, they think of someone who is judgmental, like legalistic and bigoted or whatever. And I think the reason they think that is because a lot of Christians who have chosen to be judgmental or legalistic or bigoted, they will use little pull quotes, lines from Paul's letters as justification for the things that they believe about stuff. And what I'm just deeply convinced of is that the actual man, the Apostle Paul, the actual work that he did, the things that he stood for, would be unrecognizable to people who want to use his words to exclude people from the faith. Like, and I'm not trying to make too fine a point of this, but I just think I'll speak personally. I used to think that Paul was a jerk. Okay. I used to hate Paul. I was like, Jesus is awesome. Paul, wet blanket, right? Yeah. I hate this guy. But now I realize that I actually have a deep respect for him. And I think now I know his story. I realize like, this is actually a very important man. And I actually really look up to him, and the characterizations that I had from my skeptical, frustrated reading of Paul in college were not the whole picture, nor were they even representative of who he actually was and what he believed. Like, for example, you know, let's just take 1st and 2nd Corinthians. What we're getting is a letter that is written in response to some first Corinthians, a letter that he's writing in response to some developments in Corinth after he left, but he spent like 2.5 years in Corinth. So we're assuming that all Paul wanted the Corinthians to know about following Jesus is in 1 Corinthians, when in reality, no, what he really wanted them to know was the 2.5 years that he spent with them. And here are some corrections and some like details that he's responding to. And so when we take 1 Corinthians and we think, well, that's what Paul thinks, we're missing the fact that, no, this is an addendum. We're reading an addendum to 2.5 years of hands-on ministry. And so it takes more work to understand what Paul thinks. You got to look at some of his other letters. You have to read the book of Acts. You have to piece together a much more holistic picture to understand, oh, this guy actually was deeply compassionate. He was a servant to people. He tells people, like, I wish, like, do what I showed you how to do. Work hard for others and represent Jesus by giving your life for the sake of the gospel. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the things that he did. He was not bashing people over the heads with legalism. I just don't think that's an accurate depiction of who he was.
I'm laughing because I didn't know Paul got a bad rap until I came here.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, growing up in church and being a part of church all my life, it was, you know, St. Paul, so he's good because he's a saint. Yeah.
Big winner of the March Madness tournament we did a couple years ago.
I mean, people like him.
Yeah.
And I think people like him because he's provocative.
Right.
You know, but I didn't realize he was seen in a negative light.
Yeah. It all depends on why you're using the letters of Paul. Some evangelicals love Paul because he's the closest that we get to a systematic theologian in the New Testament. The Gospels are all stories, and that's fine. But if you want to know, theology, you go to Paul, you read Romans, and he spells it all out for you. And so, like, in my undergraduate, that was what Paul was there. But then if you go to the people who are like, we want to know how to live, what's right and wrong, and who to include and who to exclude, then you go to the other parts of Paul, and you use his answers to the Corinthians questions, for example. And that's how you tell people you got to wear head coverings in church, or you got to do this, you got to do this. And these people are not allowed. And that's where we get things like you can't have, you know, no smoking, drinking, no tattoos, like whatever, that kind of stuff. It comes from that same spirit. So
most of my experience was with people who had some kind of past. And they point to Paul as a hero.
Right.
Because if Paul can be used of God.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. So I mean, that's where I am. That's the esteem with which I hold
Paul. Well, good. You don't have anything to deconstruct then, because that's how I see him too. That's how I see him too. I think he's a perfect example of what God can do to take I said at the end of my message, I was like, look, if you're carrying a bunch of burdens and shame, you think God won't forgive you. Have you executed Christians? Like, have you put people behind bars for their faith in Jesus? It's right. Like, no, you haven't. Well, listen to someone who has. That's what he is to me now. Yeah. And that's why, yeah.
So I'm a big fan of the Apostle Paul now.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's go back to zeal. Okay. So can you give me examples of where zeal is good?
You're stuck on that zeal being a bad thing. Go ahead.
Because here's why I'm asking. Examples.
Yeah, the ones I gave.
Yeah, the ones you gave in Phineas Numbers, First Kings, and Maccabees, and zeal doesn't sound good.
Right.
In The Chosen, one of the disciples is called the Zealot.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And he just seems like a really violent guy.
Right.
So give me examples of how we can use zeal for good.
Right. To be clear, there actually was a actual group of people called the Zealots that they took that same concept, the same exact thing I was talking about, and they decided that was what they were going to be, the Zealots. And they were the ones that were like assassinating Roman people. Like they were really zealous. But that was actually a formal name of a group, and he was a part of that group. So he's called the Zealot. Anyway,
So how do we do it? How do we have zeal in a really healthy way that doesn't lead to like legalism or extremism?
Am I right to equate zeal with passion?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I think so. I think it's passion in action. It's enacted passion. There it is. In this conversation, I'm zealous for a recapturing of the essence of the Apostle Paul. Like I'm passionate about that. I want people to understand that. So yeah, I'm zealous for that. I'm zealous for biblical interpretation because I love it. It's my favorite thing. So I don't know. I think it can be a positive thing.
I think sometimes people who are zealous can be seen in a negative light because maybe they're moving too quickly.
Yeah, they're a little pushy.
Or they get frustrated with others for not being as zealous as they are about the thing that they're zealous about. I have some of that going on in my home life.
Are you the zealous one?
No, I'm living.
She's referring to indigenous plants.
I'm living with a little zealot.
Yeah.
A nature zealot.
Yeah. Right. Who's passionate for all the right things, but, you know, maybe moving at a pace that is just
faster than you.
Just outpacing my husband and I.
That is a good way to describe a zealot. Even a zealot for a good thing is that they're just a little bit beyond everyone else in their passion, and it takes a while for people to catch up. And I think there's a reason why a lot of zealots can be kind of miserable in this world, because not everybody else is on board.
Yeah.
I think we just had this conversation the other day about Benjamin Lay, the prophet, the abolitionist anti-slavery guy, amazing guy. Look him up sometime, but he was a zealot. And he was out on a limb in 1600s calling for a complete abolition of slavery. Nobody else. I mean, nobody was talking about that. Mm. So it can be lonely to be a zealot, I think.
And it wasn't enough for him to just have conversations with the locals about how, you know what, slavery is really not good and it doesn't honor our Lord. And I think we should change it. That's not enough.
Yeah, to come in guns blazing.
Pulling stunts. Yeah. Stunts.
That's right. Yeah. I think you can be zealous. You can have passion and that can be misdirected as it was in the case of Paul. But I love the way that you talked about, I love the way you used the word redirected. That was a great way to describe Paul's transformation the road to, was it?
Damascus.
Damascus. I wanted to say Emmaus, but it's Damascus. Somebody told me when my daughter was real little, because she's a little zealot in her own right. She was even when she was a toddler.
Yeah.
But somebody much older and much wiser with grown children said to me, oh no, you want that fire in her.
Yeah.
Because if you can direct that toward the right thing and in the right way, she will be unstoppable.
Right.
Nobody will mess with her. Like you want that. You don't want to tame that out of her.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
The fire.
Yeah. You talked about how God's grace is wide. If it's wide enough for Paul, it's probably wide enough for us. Right. Yeah. What do you guys often hear or think the reason people cannot bring themselves to believe that are? Like, what in your pastoral experience, like what are people saying? Like, I can't, is it shame? Is it guilt? Like what are the common themes that you're hearing that people are like, if God's net is wide enough for someone like Paul, it's wide enough for you.
Yeah.
What's stopping people from accepting that?
Well, I mentioned that I hear from people a lot. So I'm primed because I've been thinking about some of what they've said, but I'll give you some examples with no names, of course. One person says,
"Oh, we drop names here."
Yeah, no, we're not doing that. That one person told me, you know, I believe in God. I believe in Jesus. I just don't think he'll ever forgive me for what I did. Mm. And I was, have you ever confessed that to anybody? Have you ever told anybody? No, I can't. It's too dark. It's too bad. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's hard to know how to respond to that. Cause I like, it's not true. He will forgive you regardless. But it's the kind of thing where this person has convinced themselves that no, what they've done is too much. Another person, his experience of making some past mistakes, he consistently, even though I consistently remind him, no, the truth is that you have been forgiven. You've been freed from the consequences of those decisions. He still lives day by day burdened with the consequences of what he did and also the fear that he'll do it again.
Yeah.
And so it's like he's not living in freedom. And that's why that image of a heavy chain around the neck felt right to me, because it's like people live, they're supposedly free in Christ, and yet they're still burdened by this weight of their past. So I could give you other examples, but those are the types of things I hear from people who are believers in Jesus and yet are still burdened by their past.
Yeah, it feels like a ball and chain. Mm-hmm. Very heavy burden that you're just, that's always with you.
Yeah.
And I think it's something, it's a burden that is borne by people who cannot forgive themselves. And therefore they feel like God can't forgive them because they can't forgive themselves.
Right.
Sometimes it's because others have not forgiven you. Mm. You know, you've wronged someone and, you know, there's a broken relationship or something and they can't forgive you. So then God probably can't forgive me either. Or, your past does not define you. Jesus calls you still. I was trying to think of what keeps people from, living into their calling. If Jesus calls you still, what keeps people from living into their calling is feeling like God can't, hasn't forgiven them or doesn't forgive them because they can't forgive themselves.
Right.
Or, you know what, everyone else still sees me as that scumbag I was years ago.
Right.
And so I'm just going to sit on the sidelines.
Yeah. I mean, would anybody have blamed Paul if after he had this encounter with Jesus, he had said, I've done terrible things and I need to spend the rest of my life repenting of what I've done. And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, would anybody have blamed him for that?
I think we'd probably have been
like, good. Yeah, yeah. You need to repent. But that wasn't what he was being called to do.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, what he was being called to do was probably way more difficult. He was being called to lay his life out on behalf of Jesus.
Oh, it's way more difficult.
To share in the sufferings of Christ and to literally die at the end of the, at the end of the day for that. Like, yeah, it was way worse. But that's what he was called to, not to just, you know, sit in shame the rest of his life for what he had done. It's pretty remarkable that he chose to say yes.
Yeah. I want to touch on what it takes to be redirected. So Jesus had to show Paul his glory and make him go blind in order for Paul to be redirected. Right. What about those of us who need redirecting, but aren't having that really extremely dramatic experience? What do we do with that? Like if I'm sitting in the audience and I'm like, all right, I need, it's baptism weekend and what you're saying is vibing with me. Yeah. And I think I need some redirection.
Yeah.
What do they do? What do they do after that?
Yeah. I kind of made a flippant comment. I said, you know, you could have God throw you to the ground on the road to Damascus, or you could just ask.
Yeah.
And I think we don't ask enough. I think I'm not saying there's no guarantee that you're going to have a transformative experience, but I think if you ask, if you give the Spirit many opportunities to like, what direction do you want me to go? In my experience, you will begin to get glimpses, get senses, hear words from other believers, hear, come across scripture passage there. God does work through his Spirit to reveal things, and it's not always dramatic. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is. And I mean, I could speak in my own life. I'm sure you guys can too, of those moments. There, those kind of hinge moments. I have one that I've talked about on the podcast before, but a moment where I was at the end of college and didn't know what I was going to do with my life. This is after I had lived in Kenya for a year, and out of the blue, I got this slideshow of images of poverty from the slums in Kenya. And it was like one image after another, almost visibly in my field of view. And I collapsed in tears. Mm. I ended up going into I had to leave the room. I was in a public setting and I had to leave the room and just, I was weeping in the bathroom and I was like washing my face. And it all made sense in my spirit, exactly what I was being called to do. Mm. 'Cause I was kind of going to this Christian college with a vague sense of, I don't know, maybe doing some kind of ministry. And it was clear. I was hearing the Lord say, you're going to give your life to injustice. Are you willing to do that?
Mm.
Like that. And in my mind, in my heart, I knew that what that meant was discomfort, loneliness, pain, compassion, fatigue. Like I knew it was going to cost a lot to do that. And I was terrified of that. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had the option to say no.
Mm.
But I said yes, and that's what led to me doing my nonprofit and all the stuff that's led to me being a pastor here.
Yeah.
That's where it all started. And so it wasn't a blinding light, but it was like a hinge moment in my life where I did have a decision to make. And so there's no promise that that's going to happen to anyone else, but I do know that it happens. And especially if you're asking, if you're open, if your posture is open, that's when you start to hear, in my opinion, in my experience. I don't know.
I have a lot of thoughts on that. And I'm trying to decide which thought to go with. Not everybody gets the blinding light experience. Some of us are redirected by what we read from those who have had blinding light experiences.
Yeah.
You know, so Paul's the one who gets the blinding light experience, but then he's redirecting the Corinthians in what he is writing and saying to them.
Right.
And now it's on them just to read it and take it to heart and be obedient and redirect themselves. God speaks so much more often through a still small voice than he does through a giant blinding light.
Right.
I think we want the undeniable giant blinding light so much more than we want the still small voice. Your dad talks a lot, Barry, about paying attention. Mm. And some of my pivot moments or bigger blinding light moments have been through that still small voice and just paying attention.
Yeah.
One of the ones that comes to mind is when you first called me to the role of pastor. Mm. And I was struggling with it. I went to Tim and Jennifer Ayers and I aired out a bunch of things with them and asked them for their prayers and their wisdom and their advice. But at the end of the day, it was literally at the end of that day, I was driving from Tim's house to the gas station. And I heard the still small voice say, there's a vacancy on the cross. It's yours if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
What a funny sentence. Because, boy, is it a cross. But there was a vacancy. And he was calling me to it. But he told me under no uncertain terms, you can say no. Mm-hmm. But there's a vacancy and it's there and it's yours if you want it. But that was not a blinding light moment.
Right.
That was a still small voice internally in my heart.
What do you think the church's role is or should be in supporting people in the process of redirection or transformation?
I think that's a great question. I think the church has a big role in the work of discipleship, which it's a churchy word that we throw around a lot, but the idea of intentionally investing in those who are maybe a few steps behind us on the journey of following Jesus. And especially when someone is beginning that process of discerning their next steps. I mean, to go back in time to that, my own sort of transition moment of my life, the number of people who were so supportive, who came alongside, who invested in me, who taught me about leadership, who taught me about cross-cultural travel and how to start a nonprofit. Like, I had an army of people around me who were deeply engaged in investing in me. And that my dream would be that would be the case for every single person at Grace who starts to follow that call, starts to be redirected in their life's purpose, whether that's in full-time ministry or whether that's in your career or your schooling or whatever, to have the church say, yeah, and we'll be on the road with you and we'll equip you. We'll give you the tools that you need. That's my dream. I think that would be an incredible thing. And I think we need to create the space in our worship services through teaching people how to pray and be silent and retreats. Like, we need to learn how to create the space for people to have those experiences with God. We did that with a staff retreat. We gave everybody on the staff retreat like an hour and a half alone with God. And we gave them some prompts, but the number of people who came away from that experience saying, I heard from God and took away some things. We just gave them space and we can do that. We can do that for our people.
I wrote down our mission is we make disciples of Jesus and launch them in mission to God. And that after listening to this, that may as well, or might be, we teach you about Jesus. You experience Jesus here, and then we help you redirect your life to his passions and purposes or something like that. But that implies that people already know what their passions and talents are. Do you think the church has a role beyond or deeper than that? Like, should we be helping people discover what their passions and talents are, or is it like, Once you've understood what you're really good at or what you're zealous about, we're gonna put you on the right path.
Let us know when you know what.
What is our responsibility as pastors and as the church?
Jed runs a young adults program here on Thursday nights, and I know that my husband Jedediah, he's passionate about helping young adults start to kind of discover their spiritual giftedness. If they can identify those things as young adults and start getting curious and living into those things or learning more about what their spiritual gift may be, how that might help literally shape the direction of their adult lives. So I think the church plays a vital role in helping people identify the gift that God gave them. Again, it's like my daughter being zealous when she was little and somebody telling me, no, that's who she is. And you want her to be that way. You just want to take that zeal and you want to channel it in the right direction. When you said Jesus doesn't always change our identity, sometimes he just redirects it. Follow me as I follow Christ, as we do life together, I should be able to help identify certain God-given innate traits in the people I'm walking with and call that out of them. The old I see in you conversation.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
When you ask about like what's the church's responsibility, I feel like there's what's the staff of Grace Church and the programs we create and our responsibility. But then there's also, okay, everyone listening to the sound of my voice.
Yeah.
You,
the community.
You are the church.
Yeah. Right.
When we're talking about the church, we're talking about y'all.
Yeah.
We're talking about
right.
you. What's the church's responsibility? At this pastor's thing that I was at on Saturday, my mentor pastor, he's got his own diagram of what the life of a disciple looks like, with starting at salvation and discipleship and spiritual formation. And he kind of has it like a winding pathway. And a lot like what we've talked about here with that valley of bewilderment that we hit a wall.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of that wall, we start discovering our destiny. He's talking about something very similar. And we looked at that diagram for a long time, just me, him, and Jed. Everybody else had left and we stayed back talking. And again, as pastors, what is our role in helping someone through that journey of discipleship and spiritual formation and breaking through that wall where a lot of people leave the faith? They hit a wall,
a
crisis of faith, and they trail off. Well, how do we help them break through that wall to get to the other side? And then how do we equip them to then help others break through their wall?
Right.
You know, this living thing that we are, this perpetual thing that we are, the church, I just don't want that to be in our minds in any way limited to the three of us at this table.
Yeah.
Well, I surely hope not.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'll add just, this is kind of for those that would want to speak into others' lives and for those that are waiting to figure out what's that direction, what's that calling, the best thing you can be doing right now is to just be serving anywhere, like especially at church, but anywhere. But use your gifts that you have or the things that you like, or even just like things you're willing to do and put some time in with the community, because that's the environment where you begin to see both things that God is doing in yourself as well as things that God is doing in others. And you can start to call that out in one another. If you're just sitting at home waiting for the bolt from the blue, waiting for the blinding light to tell you what to start doing, that you might not ever hear it, but it's when you're in the out in the world, actually serving and caring for people. And it doesn't have to be some perfect fit for exactly who you are. I mean, you could just greet people at the door and at Grace on Sunday mornings, and suddenly you're a part of a team. You've got some people you're interacting with, and you're using a gift of welcome. Who knows what God will do with that as that happens week after week and as you're formed. All that to say, it's if you just sit at home, I don't know you'll get that redirection. It's when you're trying to follow that you begin to start hearing that voice, and others can start calling things out in you that you maybe didn't see in yourself.
And you're in close proximity to other believers who are on that journey and on that path.
Yeah, they're doing it too.
I think of a moment of redirection in my life. I wrote in my journal from what you had said, your past does not define you. And then I skipped a line and left a space and wrote, Jesus calls you still. Well, I can identify the bridge between those two lines in my life. Your past does not define you. Jesus calls you still. I've talked about it on the podcast before. There was a season in my life where I felt wholeheartedly that I had been disqualified from ministry, and I was just going to slowly fade into the background and just attend church, just be, not serve, because I felt like my past did define me. And when I was telling a friend, I feel like I've disqualified myself from ministry, that friend said, I'm sorry you thought you were ever qualified to begin with.
Yeah.
Jesus calls you still. Hmm. That was such a light bulb moment for me of really, there's still, I mean, and this was, I don't know, almost 15 years ago in Chicago. Yeah. That's before I ever met you guys.
Right.
But Jesus calls me still. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm sorry you ever thought you were qualified to begin with.
That's good.
And he was not a pastor. He was just a friend that was a fellow believer in close proximity. And that could be any number of you, again, listening to this podcast, who's already in your life that you could encourage, that you could help redirect with even just one sentence, the way my friend redirected my whole life with that one sentence.
Mm. Anything else on Paul?
I mean, we could be here all day, so I'll say no, nothing else for now, but let's keep talking. Can I give a little plug for my Revelation class? Is it too early for that? Is it too early for that? I don't know. You're the one who oversees communications.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, all right. I've got a class coming up. I'm going to announce it this weekend, but I wanted the friends of the pod to hear it first.
Ooh,
I've got
exclusive.
a class all about the book of Revelation, and I am so excited about it. It will probably not be what most people are expecting, but it will be a class that is going to help anybody who wants to understand what the heck this book is all about. I think it'll actually become, at least like me, a book that was once written off that becomes kind of actually pretty crucial and integral to your faith. So if you're interested, come along. It's not going to be what you're expecting, but I think it's going to be good. So
will you be singing?
No singing. That was a one-time deal, and that is over.
I think I speak for all of us when I say we want more of it. Come on, Barry, the singing preacher.
That's my dad's thing. That's not my thing. You're thinking of my dad. He's the singing preacher.
You just became the singing preacher.
We'll see. It's not a gift of mine, and it helps only when I'm like kind of crying, so you can't hear my lack of.
That's not true. Your notes were strength. On point.
Well, thanks. I've got intonation is about all I've got. I don't have like anything else.
So when's your class start?
May. It's the second Wednesday of May, and I can't remember the date off the top of my head, but you'll hear about it. I'm just saying, friends of the pod, get excited. Wednesdays for 4 weeks in May. It's a class on the book of Revelation.
May 8th?
Possibly.
That's the second Wednesday.
Oh, that might be it.
Okay.
Anyway.
Where do we go next then? What are we doing?
So the next thing we're doing, this new series is called All in the Family, and we are going to kind of ask the Spirit, what is it that you are saying to the people of Grace Church right now, the family of Grace Church, and specifically looking at different roles or life stages that people have in their lives. So we're going to talk to husbands. What is God saying to wives? What is God saying to children, to parents, to elders, and to singles? What is God saying to the single people in our midst? And I am really excited about this series.
Oh, good.
And I'm realizing now maybe we should have started with not husbands, because I'm coming in guns blazing.
Coming in hot.
Guns blazing this weekend. So if you're a husband, buckle up.
Uh-oh.
So anyway.
So I like the way you put it. And we started working on this series a couple weeks or months back. And I like how you put it in your kind of description or your overview as an invitation to all these different types of people. So I'm really excited to
what's God's invitation to the husbands? Yeah. What's God's invitation?
Yeah. All right. We'll do that. And we'll catch up next week. Barry, you're actually not going to be here next week. You're gone.
Oh yeah. Shoot. Unless we can figure out how to call me in, we'll figure it out.
But yeah. So
you guys can talk about it while I leave the scorching earth behind me.
I don't even know what that means.
My message to the husbands.
Oh yeah. All right.
In the aftermath.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So for now, Maren, will you please send us out?
I will. Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God.
And we'll see you on the other side of Sunday.